Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Days after having a blood clot removed from above his left eye, Arizona Senator John McCain was diagnosed with an aggressive type of brain cancer called glioblastoma. It's the same brain cancer that killed Senator Edward Kennedy in 2009 and Beau Biden, son of former Vice President Joe Biden, 2 years ago. There is still no cure for glioblastoma, but researchers are eyeing a new promising set of therapies. Joining us by phone is radiation oncologist at Ohio State University's Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute, Dr. Raju Raval. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Did I pronounce it right? It's glio?
Some people pronounce it glioblastoma or glioblastoma.
Okay. What are its symptoms?
So patients can present with a variety of symptoms, anywhere from headache. Sometimes you can have seizure activities or weakness or even numbness. So every patient is different, but any of those very unusual set of symptoms often lead to a patient getting first a CT scan of the head and often an MRI to identify a tumor.
They also sound like symptoms that a lot of people would ignore.
We do believe that some types of these tumors can grow for a very long time slowly, and that patients I've had before notice subtle changes, and only later, when maybe something more significant occurs, do they seek care. So it is possible that sometimes these tumors can grow slowly.
How common is this, you know, to have Ted Kennedy, Beau Biden, and now
John McCain?
It seems more common, is it?
Indeed, it's actually quite rare. Anywhere from maybe 13,000 to 18,000 people in the United States per year would be diagnosed with a grade 4 glioblastoma. And there's really no clear known causes for this type of tumor. Historically, maybe in the distant past, kids who were treated with radiation to the scalp for tinea have had a known risk factor. But in modern day, with patients who are diagnosed now, there's really no known either genetic or exposure. So it's just, you know, an unexpected, unfortunate, random event, and it's rare.
When you say grade 4, do you mean like a stage 4?
No, so... Okay. In comparison to other types of cancer, when we say stage 4 cancer for like a lung cancer or a breast cancer, that really means it's spread around the body. These are tumors that grow within the brain and are from the brain. And instead of staging, we have grading, grade 1 being a very benign tumor that could be cured with surgery alone, to a grade 4, which are glioblastomas, which require surgery, if it's possible, along with a six-week course of radiation therapy and then a pill chemotherapy, both during radiation and then for about 6 months after. And that would be the current standard of care. However, really, we are trying to take both clinical trials and new treatment avenues and research in rapid new directions. And the reason for that is that historically, patients have had only a median overall survival of about 14 to 18 months with the current standard of care, meaning that half the patients can live longer than that, but unfortunately half are no longer with us at that time point. And that's really an unacceptable place to be. And so where the research is going for the type of tumor that John McCain was just diagnosed with is adding kind of a new type of cancer therapy called immunotherapy, which you may have heard of, has really been a revolution in our field. It's now approved for six other types of cancers and is being tested in virtually all types of cancer. And there's a number of agents and a number of companies developing these types of treatments. And really the idea behind immunotherapy is finding ways to boost your own immune system to detect and then eliminate cancer. In animal models, some of the research that we had done previously at Johns Hopkins before I came to Ohio State University showed that in animal models of glioblastoma, using radiation along with some of these new forms of immune therapy, we're able to essentially control or cure these animals of glioblastoma and prevent them from ever having it again. And so we are taking these avenues forward here at Ohio State, where we have brought four clinical trials adding on immune therapy on top of the current standard of care. And these are trials led either by myself or the director of neuro-oncology, Dr. Vinay Puttavalli, or the chair of neurosurgery, Dr. Russell Lonser, in new directions, both for patients who have newly diagnosed glioblastoma and those who have recurrent glioblastoma.
How do you know when somebody is a candidate for immunotherapy?
So a lot of these trials require testing of your tissue to confirm either certain biomarkers that you may have that are positive or negative, and whether or not, let's say, a surgery was able to be performed versus only a biopsy. But we're trying to find a combination of trials that can allow for virtually every patient to be included, because we feel with the current standard of care, though you know that's an improvement over the distant past, we're not satisfied by those outcomes. And so we're trying to find trials that everyone can at least have a chance to be enrolled in.
And there's a high chance with glioblastoma that somebody, well, that it'll come back no matter what. And that's because of the nature of the cancer, how it's formed in the brain?
So these tumors come from the kind of supportive cells that go between and around our nerve cells within the brain. Even if you do a surgery to take out everything you can see from an MRI scan, we know that even up to a few centimeters away, these tumors have tentacles. And even despite our most aggressive therapy with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, when these tumors come back, up to 90% of the time, they come back right where they were before. So there's something challenging about how these tumors continue to survive despite aggressive treatments. And one of those things that we believe is actually the immune system, and that these tumors are one of the most immunosuppressive types of tumors. I mean, they actively find ways to prevent the immune system from seeing them or eliminating them. And that's kind of why we're taking on these new clinical trials to push forward. And in addition to that, some of the research laboratories that I have and my mentors, Dr. Bill Carson and Michael Caligiuri, they're really developing kind of the cutting-edge combination immune therapy. So in addition to the ones that are already approved, they're adding in new forms of either new pill treatments for leukemias, lymphomas, breast cancer, melanoma, and even we're adding radiation in my laboratory to those ideas to see can we find even better combinations that could be a future clinical trial.
When you're talking about immunotherapy, how much does genetics play a role in determining candidates for that?
So the nice thing about immunotherapy is that the treatment itself actually just boosts your own immune system. And though it doesn't work for every patient, there are a subset, depending on the tumor type, where we believe there can be a really broad application. And the research where it's going now is finding ways there. How are these tumors masking themselves from the immune system? How are they preventing the immune system from seeing them? And what we're learning is that a single treatment is probably not going to work alone, but combining maybe different forms of treatment that get around that mask, there's no reason that our immune system shouldn't be able to eradicate our tumors, because the immune system is designed to see anything that's not self. So anything that's different from our normal tissue should be recognized and eliminated, like a virus infection or a bacterial infection or even a kidney transplant. And so we need to find the ways that these tumors are hiding from the immune system. And with the right combination, I think we will reach a point where maybe the majority of cancers, all types, will be controlled with immunotherapy as maybe a backbone of treatments that will be in the future.
Is immunotherapy, though, wouldn't it be more effective if it were employed before the tumor? I guess, are we looking at ways to boost our immune systems in general?
That's a great question. And what we think is happening is that in everyone, our immune systems are active and maybe even eliminating small cancers in our bodies our whole lives. But somehow, these tumors are upregulating mechanisms that our normal body would use to hide from the immune system, because we don't want to reject our normal tissues, and kind of subverting themselves to use those same mechanisms to hide from our immune system. And it is those mutations or changes that occur in these tumors that are allowing them to form into clinically visible tumors.
Glioblastoma is one of those, is a brain tumor it is brain cancer. It's not another cancer from another part of the body.
It's not a metastasis. Mm-hmm. It does not come from somewhere else in the body and spread to the brain. These are tumors that either form in the brain or stay in the brain, sometimes in the spinal cord. But so what should be something that we can see and take out and treat locally, despite all of our efforts, has been quite challenging to overcome.
And does age matter? Bo Biden was a young man, youngish, I guess, a lot younger than me. And but Ted Kennedy and John McCain are older.
You know, these are rare tumors that present in every age from children to patients in their 80s, like John McCain. However, the majority of patients are in their 60s or 70s when they're diagnosed. You know, like one of the things for John McCain, I would hope that maybe at the Mayo Clinic where he got some of his treatment in Arizona, that they will offer clinical trials or additional options for him. You know, it's kind of ironic that, you know, he flew back to Washington yesterday to vote on continuing debate. You know, I think I did have a chance to meet John McCain in 2001. He's a war hero, a very pleasant senator, and it was an honor to get to meet him. But I hope with his speech that he said that, you know, I think there needs to be an avenue of bipartisanship. I had hoped that, you know, maybe the Senate or the House would work to improve on the Affordable Care Act and not just repeal it. But, you know, I think it's an interesting time with his diagnosis flying back to Washington and implications of that.
Because research and development in the cures for these diseases depends on the coverage.
Yeah, you know, like we need support. You know, at the James, we're fortunate that we get a lot of community support here with Ohio State University. I would encourage anyone who wants to support the mission of the James. You know, we have our annual Pelotonia bike race in just 2 weeks on the August 4th weekend, and to go to pelotonia.org and support our mission here, both on the clinical trials to offer these opportunities for patients and also on the research side. And so, you know, I think universally everyone agrees that we want to continue to lead in healthcare, in research, and I hope whatever the debate over the next 20 hours and whatever comes out of that will be something that maybe there'll be some bipartisan support. I think that would be a hope for everyone.
We shall see. Dr. Raju Raval, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Raju Raval is an expert in glioblastoma. That's the kind of cancer that has U.S. Senator John McCain has been diagnosed with. Dr. Raval is a radiation oncologist at Ohio State University. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Michigan-based web developer Madeline Parker recently sent an email to her team letting them know she needed to take a few days to focus on her mental health. When the CEO of the company responded with an email thanking Madeline for normalizing mental health issues in the office, she was surprised and moved to share the exchange on Twitter. The post has since gone viral, sparking a larger conversation about how mental health is treated at work. Madeline Parker joins us by phone from Michigan. Welcome to the show, Madeline.
Hi, thank you.
Also joining us by phone is Director of the Partnership for Workplace Mental Health at the American Psychiatric Association, Claire Miller. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Thanks so much.
Claire, I just want to start with you briefly. I want to get to Madeline right away, but I want to start with you just about what's the incidence? How do you measure the issue of mental health in the workplace?
Sure. I just have to start by thanking Madeline and thanking Ben for your leadership and amazing, you know, going public with this has been just such a huge boost to the mental health community. So thank you. To get to your question, first and foremost, mental illnesses are extremely, extremely common. About 1 in 5 adults experience a mental illness. And we know that this has a huge impact on people's lives and particularly their lives at work. And one way that we sort of look at this and measure this is looking at absenteeism and what we call presenteeism, where people are physically at work but not able to be fully productive. And the economic impact associated with just depression alone, just one illness, is $210 billion annually, of which about half of that is absenteeism and presenteeism. So this is a really common issue, and It's a common experience for there to be impacts on the workplace. And at the end of the day, not only does this represent people who are in some cases having trouble struggling, but represents an opportunity for employers to be supportive to employees, just as Ben did.
Madeline Parker, we're going to get to your boss, Ben Congleton, in a few minutes. But Madeline Parker, what possessed you? And that sounds kind of pejorative, and I don't mean to sound that way. I don't mean to sound incredulous, but in a way, it is incredulous that someone felt comfortable enough to say, "Hey, guys, I'm not out with the flu. I'm out with mental health."
Yeah, so I've been out, which is interesting phrasing, anyways. at work about my mental illnesses for almost 3 years now. And what originally made me feel comfortable enough to share with them was sort of taking stock of what our culture was like. And I noticed that there was focus on self-care, on maintaining healthy work-life balance. One of our values is chill, just chill out. Notice that, like, you need time to recover from work. And that one of our other values is practice empathy. And just having this focus on people and having, knowing that they cared about me as an individual made me feel like I could share that. And so since then, I've been very open.
And so, but you even then were still surprised when your boss, Ben Congleton, responded with a, "Hey, glad you brought this out in the open. Glad you did this, but glad you felt comfortable." You were still surprised by that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I send these emails, fairly often. I have chronic depression and anxiety. And, I hadn't heard from him in a while. He is the CEO. He thinks big picture, and I think, focused product work. And so to hear from him personally and to be thanked for my candor when I think it's, so normal for me, really felt amazing and was surprising.
Well, let's bring Ben Congleton on now. Ben, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I guess I'll ask the same sort of question to you, is what possessed you to respond in that way?
Well, so one thing that I've been working on personally is gratitude and really doing a good job of expressing gratitude. I think it's an important skill to exercise. And, I don't look at out of the office emails all the time, but I was glancing through out of the office emails and I saw Madeline's email and, I thought that this was a good opportunity for me to express some gratitude to Madeline. Within our organization, she's been an advocate for mental health. She's helped sort of bring awareness to mental health and really like normalize it in a way that has allowed others in the organization to sort of step up and talk about it. And I wanted to, recognize her for her courage, because every time that you mention mental health in the workplace, it's uncommon. And I thought she deserved to be called out and recognized for that, just personally.
Claire Miller, you sort of just want to squeal with delight over all of this. This is the way, it's supposed to work.
Right, right. Yeah, I know. What I was saying to someone recently was that, everyone is really talking about it. It's also kind of interesting how this has gone viral really so quickly. And Ben, I don't know if you heard me thank you, but thank you too for your response to Madeline. And I think what's remarkable here is not like that this happened, that Meredith, and I, by the way, I also have depression and anxiety. And so I can appreciate this experience also from that perspective. And so I guess what's remarkable is not that Meredith decided that she needed to take a minute and take care of her mental health and didn't come to work for a couple of days. What's remarkable is that she was open about it and that openness was greeted with such, as you say, gratitude and similar kind of candor and support. That's what's remarkable. It shouldn't be remarkable, I think you said in the piece, Ben, but it is, frankly, and that's why I think we should celebrate it, encourage more companies to have similar kinds of values and approaches.
You know, I was wondering, Ben Congleton, if you've gotten any feedback from other CEOs who say, you know, God, you know, good for you that you can afford this, but I can't afford it.
Well, so I haven't had that particular response from any CEOs, but I guess there have been sort of mid-level managers that have reached out to me with like a similar idea. And to those people, I've basically responded that ultimately your job is to motivate and to create a high-performing team. And the way to create a high-performing team is to create a place where people can bring their whole selves to work, where they aren't just like punching the clock and waiting for the day to end, right? And the way to do that is to trust your employees and to trust them to, you know, stay at home when they have the flu and to stay at home when they have mental illness, because so that they can recover and come back rested. And, you know, one idea that I've been sort of talking about recently is I would love to see a future where people are as comfortable talking about mental health in the workplace as they are talking about having a migraine or having the flu, because it affects their ability to get their job done. And, you know, organizations want to empower their employees to, you know, bring their whole selves to work and to perform at a really high level. And it's just, you know, not too surprising with this response, seeing like some of the Gallup numbers that say something like 70% of employees aren't engaged at work. So I think that this is a way of helping motivate and increase performance in our teams. And every manager should be, you know, looking for ways to do that because it helps, you know, make them successful.
Madeline Parker, have you been in other jobs before where you've sought, you know, or where you've wanted to take a break for mental health purposes and didn't feel comfortable doing it?
So this is actually my first job out of college, but I definitely have had internships where I've felt like I had to hide my mental illness because I felt that I needed to be performing as high as possible so that I could, you know, get that job offer at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
I think
that a lot of people feel that way.
You know, you and I talked, I think, before we went on the air about, you know, just the pressure of all this, you know, on the Today Show, you know, blah, 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 you know, all over the place. This has gone viral. But did it help your recovery to know that your boss was on your side? So when you're having a spell of anxiety and or depression or whatever it was, did you feel that much more refreshed?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, I've struggled with mental illness for years now. And during the first, like, 10 months at this job, I kept it to myself. And during that time, like, I had additional anxiety about losing my job over it. Mm-hmm. And now that I know that that's off the table, it's so freeing.
Wow. Yeah, I can
it
imagine.
It feels so good.
I mean, employee for life, Ben Congleton. What kind of response have you gotten from other employees at your company?
Oh, I've had so many people thank me personally. I've had lots of people, now that I've sort of like called myself out as an advocate, tell me about their personal struggles and tell me that it helps them to know that, you know, they're not alone. I mean, 1 in 5 people struggles with this. You work with people that struggle with this, mm-hmm, for sure. It's just not something that people often talk about, particularly at work.
One issue, Claire Miller, is just getting access to health care coverage that includes mental health, right?
Yeah, depending on the company.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. And the size company. Like, I mean, if you're a company with more than 50 employees and you offer mental health coverage, then it needs to be equitable to physical health care coverage. And right now there's lots of protections in place because of the ACA. It actually really reinforces why we need to really continue to work to make sure that the ACA stays available to people, because it's only because of that law that many, many more Americans do have coverage for mental health.
Ben Coggleton, before I let you go, you wrote that you couldn't believe that this is not standard practice at all organizations. What is OLARC's policy? How does this work?
So OLARC has sort of a flex PTO policy. So
paid time off. Yep.
Paid time off. Right. So sick days and vacation are all sort of bundled up under an unlimited vacation policy, which, you know, I know it's sort of an uncommon policy, but it basically it's a policy built on trust. And it's a policy where we've realized that, you know, actually we find that our employees don't take as much vacation as we'd like them to take. Because mm-hmm. without having those allocated days, I think that sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, take the time to unplug and to step back from their work because everyone is, you know, really engaged in what they're doing. And so, you know, our struggle is in more just making sure that people get that time to unplug and get that time to reset. And for me, like, just my general thinking here is that mental health is health, right? So if you're going to tell your employees that they should stay home when they're ill, that completely applies to mental health. So to me, it's just a very, very simple concept that mental health is a real thing. You know, one in six Americans are medicated annually for mental illness. And, you know, one in five are reported to have, a diagnosable mental health condition. And so just given that knowledge and the fact that, you know, 20% of your workforce is dealing with this issue, this is just something that we as companies just need to understand and address.
Ben Coggleton, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Ben Coggleton. He's CEO of OLARC, where another guest of mine, Madeline Parker, works, and where she took a couple days off recently, announced it in an email and for mental health purposes. And her boss, Ben Coggleton, supported her, sent her back a note saying, yay, you. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, Madeline Parker still with us, and also Claire Miller of American Psychiatric Association. Laura in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm so happy to hear this subject addressed, as I am mentally ill. And my situation was slightly different. But we got to start speaking up because people, it has a genetic component very often. And people aren't ashamed to say they have other illnesses. It's bad, but it's another illness. Now, in work, it did start to affect my work to protect myself because I knew someone. I love the place I work. I love most of the people. I went to the person who did employee relations, and I actually enacted the Family Leave and Health Act. I was very supported by her and by 99% of the employees. Unfortunately, I did get some questioning by my supervisor, who is not a very person of depth of understanding, like, well, you know, if you call off, how do we know, can we count on you? But, you know, that kind of counts for anything. And I do believe I was eventually laid off in the bad part of the recession, mm-hmm. and I kind of was not a replaceable person. So I do think it had something to do with that. I don't regret it at all. Mm-hmm. I knew there was a possibility because of the mixture in my company of a different reaction, mm-hmm. but I refused to be ashamed. And I went through a really hard time because it was a bad time, but I feel better off in the long run. And I think we need to start talking about this honestly, even if it's not always a perfect ending.
Well,
because only by coming out of the closet, so to speak.
Right. Well, Laura, thank you for calling and sharing that with us. We appreciate it. Take care. Claire Miller, how do you start those conversations in the workplace?
I mean, I think it really depends on a lot of different factors and what the particular circumstances are, the particular culture. I think Madeline had a a very positive experience, made possible clearly by how supportive her company is and the very values of that company. And that is certainly not going to be the case at every company. But mm-hmm. we do know that if we want to eliminate stigma in the United States and elsewhere, the best way to do this, and this is according even to research, the best way to do this is for people to start talking about it and to talking about their personal experience with mental illnesses, because then it takes it from numbers, 1 in 6, 1 in 5, to real people and real people's experiences and the value of all of those people. So I think, you know, depending on what position you have at the company, there's lots of different ways that you can address mental health and be positive about mental health. But no matter what, I do think that it starts with just talking about it.
You know, could all of this have happened if a person like Madeline Parker wasn't around? You know, somebody of that age group, somebody who's new to the workplace, relatively new to the workplace, and somebody who thinks about posting something on Twitter, too. Right?
You know, there's been a lot of discussion, I think, about workers of different generations and, mm-hmm. and their ability to sort of speak freely about mental health. And I think that that is a huge piece of it. But I also wonder, and, you know, we can ask Madeline, but I also wonder if Madeline worked for a really conservative company where she was afraid to disclose, even though there are obviously legal protections in place. I mean, mm-hmm. we have the ADA, these, you know, there are FMLA, there are very specific laws that protect someone's for, you know, circumstances exactly like this. But, you know, you do wonder, it's sort of that more quiet, insidious kind of stigma where that I think creates fear for people. And if you worked for a really different kind of company, you know, would you have felt as comfortable? I think it's a interesting question.
Yeah, I don't think I would have. I don't think I would have felt as comfortable. And I'm not sure that I would work at such a company now. Now I know what to look for.
Like I said, employee for life, right?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, I feel valued and I feel trusted and I feel respected. And I think that everyone should be able to feel like that in their jobs. Once you feel valued, you want to demonstrate that value. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to live up to what they think of me.
Well, Alex in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You're a small business owner. Go ahead.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I struggle with anxiety. You know, my mother is diagnosed bipolar. So this is a issue that's definitely hits close to home for me. As a small business owner in Clintonville, you know, we offer our employees 8 hours of accrued PTO each month. So I kind of wanted to get a gauge from the person who is the business owner or the CEO of this company you guys are talking about. Is 8 hours a good place to be? You know, that's 12 days paid off a year for sickness or vacation. Yeah. Or should we try, you know, or do people need more than that? Because as, you know, looking as a business owner online and trying to figure out what's reasonable, you know, sometimes it seems like you're trying to get away with as little as possible, you know? So I just want to know, like, what is best, what an average.
Claire Miller,
you know,
what
policy
do you,
would be.
Yeah, Claire Miller, you know, from where you sit, director of the Partnership for Workplace Mental Health at the American Psychiatric Association, what is there a rule of thumb? Is there, can you give us a thumbnail on what works, what doesn't?
In terms of actual PTO amount?
Yes.
So I think it really depends. I'm sorry to answer every question with that, but I do think it depends on sort of what your specific industry is and your business, and you'd want to look at, I think, competitors sort of in your space and size, because certainly, like, the work needs to get done, right? I think that what we see in the United States, and we've seen lots of studies about this, is that, you know, people end the year and they are losing vacation days, right? And I'm reminded of something that a senior leader at a very large consulting house noted to me recently, and he said that people were burning out at the job, and he realized that people were burning out and leaving the organization, and he realized that they all had vacation time left. And so it proposed sort of this fundamental question of, like, well, why didn't you take the time, you know, that we're giving you? So I think that, you know, just like Ben said, part of the challenge here is to create environments and to create a culture where people know that it's okay to take time off. I mean, that's why we have time off in this country, right? It's to rejuvenate yourself, to refresh yourself, and to, you know, take care of your health. So rather than it being one sort of rule of thumb, I think it depends on what your company is able to do and still get the work done. But I would lean toward, are there ways to be more generous and more flexible and create an environment where people want to come to work, but also know that it's okay to take care of themselves?
All right. Alex, thanks a lot for that call. Claire Miller, thanks you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Claire Miller is the director of the Partnership for Workplace Mental Health at the American Psychiatric Association. And Madeline Parker, thanks to you. Really appreciate your time as well.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Madeline Parker is a web developer at OLARC. That's a live chat customer support service in Michigan. She recently let her team know that she was going to take a few days off for mental health. And her boss, the CEO of OLARC, responded with an attagirl. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for being open about it and being supportive. It's gone viral since then. She posted that exchange in a tweet. So you can probably find that online. If not, we'll get you a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sanitizing a child's environment is normal parenting in America. But scientist Rob Knight says not so fast. Instead of washing the pacifier when it drops to the floor, go ahead and link that binky and pop it right back in your kid's mouth. Knight is a professor of pediatrics and computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego. He's co-written a new book entitled Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, so you're not just talking about picking the pacifier up off the floor. You're talking about licking the pacifier. How does that boost a child's health?
The saliva in your mouth has a whole lot of antimicrobial compounds that get rid of the bad bacteria. And on top of that, you're providing a lot of good bacteria to your child through the bacteria that are in your mouth already. So, as you said, keeping kids sterile is something people like to do a lot of. But really, people have gotten a bit overboard in the last few decades, and we're trying to address that and restore that balance.
Why have we gone overboard in the last few decades? What happened to sort of put us on this trajectory?
Well, what happened was a very reasonable trajectory from public health findings about transmission of disease by feces, like with cholera and so forth. And there's been tremendous public health advances in keeping water clean and so forth. But keeping all your surfaces too clean, it turns out, prevents exposure to beneficial microbes, and your child really needs those to develop the immune system successfully.
What are some things that parents get wrong about cleanliness? So you want a clean home. You don't want, you know, a pigsty, but what are they doing too much of?
Right. Well, there's a difference between clutter and dirt. But the issue is, using way too much disinfectant and way too much antimicrobial soap and so on. Keeping your kid away from sources of beneficial microbes like, healthy dirt, healthy animals, other healthy people, that kind of thing. And one thing that's very interesting is that, especially with respect to things like the increase in asthma and allergies that have just been exploding over the last few decades, like when I was a kid, peanut allergies were almost unheard of, for example.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that seems to be your immune system overreacting to anything that it's exposed to, because it doesn't have those natural exposures to damp it down. And so, so for example, in Amish country, where people are a lot more exposed to those natural sources of microbes, asthma and allergies are almost unheard of.
There are some people who don't get their kids inoculated against disease, and I'm wondering about them. Do they have a different set of issues if they're not getting their kids vaccinated?
Yeah, so this is very different from the from vaccinations. So so vaccines very specifically target some of the few bacteria and viruses that are really harmful. And so when you're vaccinating your kid, you're not eliminating the diversity of healthy microbes that you would be if you're just, wiping everything with antibacterial wipes all the time. So, so vaccination is a tremendous public health success and is definitely something that you should continue to do. And what's really interesting is that people seem to be worried about vaccines and much less worried about taking antibiotics, whereas antibiotics are really like, if you think of your kids developing ecosystem as being like a rainforest, antibiotics are like wiping it out with napalm and really wiping out a lot of the wiping out a lot of the good stuff as well as the bad stuff. So that's not to say that you shouldn't use antibiotics when they're medically necessary, but they're really something that you want to reduce the use of.
What about all the different kinds of wipes we have out there for kids? The when you're changing diapers, they're everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere, and I think I think again what you're seeing is excessive paranoia. So obviously you don't want your kids licking a counter where you've just cut up some raw chicken, or crawling around on the floor of a hospital or somewhere where there's a lot of garbage or that kind of thing. But if you're trying to keep everywhere too clean, a good analogy for it is when your immune system's developing, it's going to pick up on whatever's in the environment. So it's sort of like if there's no signal there, it's like having a radio that's between stations, and you're just turning up the volume and turning up the volume until eventually you're going to pick up some static. And the issue is that if you get any kind of signal later on, like from a peanut or something, your immune system is just going to be completely overboard in responding to it, because you've turned up the gain so much by keeping everything so clean. And that's why it's really important to keep ongoing contact with those healthy microbes to provide the signal that we've co-evolved with as humans.
You know, when I was reading about this and about your book, the first thing I kind of thought of in my own childhood was how we just spent hours on end, literally in the dirt, all the time, just playing in dirt. We didn't even have a sandbox. We just played in dirt by the side of the road. And there must have been all kinds of junk in that. My mom, didn't even think twice about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there's concerns about tetanus, for example, but if you have your tetanus shots, then that's no longer a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so the few things that you're at risk from picking up are pretty treatable compared to the chronic disease that you may be setting yourself up with for life by keeping things too clean.
How do you know if something like an allergy, asthma-related or other kind of allergy, isn't something you inherited versus lack of exposure to, say, like dogs?
So that's a very good question. So if you look at the rate of change in asthma and allergies, it's been completely exploding over the last 30 years or so. And so you're talking about one or two human generations. And for that change in the amount of asthma and the amount of allergies to be due to changes in human gene frequencies, either having asthma would have to make you incredibly sexy and you would have had a lot, so you have a whole lot of kids.
Yeah.
Like the kiss of death for your dating profile or whatever. And I think if that had happened, it would have been very noticeable from a public health perspective, right? So we're seeing a very rapid change in the disease. That can't be due to a change in human genes. So that doesn't mean that genes aren't important as one factor in these complex systems. They certainly are genetic.
Is this the same kind of issue when we're talking about what's in your gut?
Yes, and in fact, your gut microbiome has a huge impact on whether you'll get asthma or allergies later on.
Huh.
And that's very interesting because a lot of people expected that the airway microbiome would be most important. But most of the research, and this includes research in mice, shows that it's the gut microbiome that's really the most important for framing asthma and allergies later.
How much research is going on out there to back up this things like your book, Dirt is Good, and other treatises on this issue?
There's hundreds of studies going on right now all over the world. So some of the exciting work's coming out of Canada on the child cohort and with Brett Finley's work on mouse models at UBC. There's a lot of work going on in the United States. There's some very exciting work going on in Australia where they've actually been able to reverse peanut allergies using a probiotic. And all over the world, because of the rise in chronic diseases, there's a huge amount of research looking into different causes of that, including the microbiome.
What are probiotics? How do they work? I see them at the farmer's market.
Right. Well, I won't comment on whether the ones at the farmer's market are going to work or not. But what a probiotic is an organism that you... like a microorganism that you eat when it's alive that has a beneficial effect on your health. And part of the issue with probiotics is there's a lot of kinds out there, and public enthusiasm is very high, but the regulatory framework is not very strict. So they're regulated as food supplements. The way to think about it is, if someone said, like, I felt sick and I heard that drugs were good, so... I went to the store and I got a lot of drugs and I took them and now I feel better. You'd have a lot of questions for that person, right? Especially if they told you that they thought everyone should take a lot of drugs all the time. But with probiotics, there's a lot less of that kind of skepticism, despite the fact that what you're taking is basically a live organism that's a very complex factory for making a whole lot of additional chemicals. So in general, they're not going to do any harm. But the ones that will actually do you good are a very small minority of what's on the market, and there's been very few clinical studies, most of which have been done in Europe or Australia.
Most people will listen to their doctor. What has the reaction to all of this been from pediatricians?
Pediatricians are really excited about this whole new window that we're opening into their patients, understanding how the microbiome influences the development of the child and the child's immune system. And the more we understand about how to keep the microbiome healthy and therefore how to keep the child healthy, the better everyone can do for their patients. Enthusiasm has been very high in the pediatric community.
Has there been any pushback from the, the cleaning industry, the people who manufacture all the baby wipes?
You laugh, but yes.
really?
So in particular, some of the manufacturers of baby wipes are very anxious not to be, not to be considered like the next BPA or something like that, right? And actually, the FDA recently banned triclosan, which is one of the most common uses of antimicrobials, banned it from consumer products because the evidence that it was doing any good was pretty limited, whereas the evidence it was causing harm in the environment was considerably greater.
Well, Rob Knight, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks again for having me on, and hope your listeners are increasingly interested in what the microbiome can do for them.
Rob Knight is a professor of pediatrics and computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego. He's co-written a new book. It's entitled Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.